Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
Welcome to another podcast while driving. This one's going to be about Remembrance Day. This is 100 years since there was an unconditional surrender, apparently, by the Germans at on the 11th of the 11th, at 11 minutes past 11, possibly 11 milliseconds and so forth. And I suppose the interesting things that I found out is about the Austro-Hungarian Empire, a dual kingdom, one state, two kingdoms, or two states, whatever it is, one government, which fought alongside the Germans, and they actually stopped fighting, I think, on the 6th or 9th of November, a few days before they surrendered to the Italians. So things were obviously really quietening down by that point in time. Now, I suppose the generally interesting thing is that there was a series of treaties that essentially were set up and triggered, and actually triggered everyone getting into World War One. And one of them, obviously, there was the Prince Ferdinand, who got assassinated in Austria. So no, it's not in Austria, in Serbia. So it's all Croatia around that area, all in the Balkans. There's an assassination there. Yeah, of course. Wanted to assassinate people, you want to get in and doing it. So there's not much really, we're trying to understand what it's all for. But then there was a series of treaties that when Germany invaded Belgium, there was a automatic series of things which committed England to war, which is a pretty amazing thing. And we've got a sort of a convoluted view of it all. One of the Georg von Trapp of The Sound of Music, so we believe, so I've been told, it was a U-boat commander in World War One, sinking fairly indiscriminately Allied shipping. So it's all sort of confused. We've got a sort of romantic view of things. There was a forest. I just got to remember where the forest was in France, in which the armistice was signed, and this carriage was held as a memorial to French superiority. And of course, when Hitler invaded in 1940. Bear in mind, he was in there for a brief stint, four years, which seems a long time, and a short time. Hitler made them sign the surrender back inside the same carriage, and then he blew it up. Now, I don't know what do they do today, where they blow things up today. Well, yeah, I suppose they blew up the Twin Towers. Blowing a piece of infrastructure up seems to have a profound effect, whereas if you whittle away someone's rights or things like that, it hasn't. And so we had a huge fraction of the Australian population. So one town, little hamlets would lose a good third. One town lost half its able-bodied men in the war. And in general, I don't know, it's really hard to relate to how these people thought. They really did think that was called the Australian Imperial Force. And they were really believing in World War One, they were fighting for the British Empire. and there was sort of a strange relationship with Britain. I don't know how it would go. I'm sure it was perceived on our side, but not necessarily on their side. And the Australians were better paid than the British troops, and withdrawn from battle for a little while to be retrained out as more modern soldiers towards the end of the war in 1918. Towards the end, they're withdrawn, trained up, and then re-engaged with more coordinated attacks. That's pretty sad. Well, it's not sad. It's that they had air, military, everything coordinated and timed like clockwork. And this was a generalised, I think, British innovation, but we tend to sort of claim it as an Australian innovation. And a lot of this coordination, coordinated warfare type of stuff, I don't know how it came. It's more like a managed major operation, so rather than having the heroic cavalry commander being given a little set of written orders and they do one sort of action, follow out one set of orders, there's a much more coordinated form of doing. I'm thinking of the Napoleonic Wars and how that went through. And it's sort of a very much more brutal situation, and there's a lot more psychological warfare towards the end in terms of there was sort of the Germans were nasties, but I think the Australians were particularly nasty to the Germans in terms of going out there and just terrorising them. And I just think that's I suppose that's war. It's sort of a strange, seems strange, just keeping my speed limit right down here. A strange direction, because say a lot of the modern Australian army stuff is of a different ilk. It's about winning the peace and establishing order, rules of war, rather than extending rules of war. This is when, in peacekeeping, I've got friends who've, a number of friends who've gone out to Rwanda, and that has sort of, going out to that Rwanda, Bosnia, where you're not in the actual conflict and you're watching it either side and you're trying to calm it down, trying to slow the pace of things down. It's and where it's to no one is to win the war is just to stop. So it is interesting. That, and similarly in Timor, people going out up to Timor, again there's a whole lot of history and ignorance to not to know, but just to unfold as things go along. That the history of Timor is a fairly complex history. So Timor is a little island, which doesn't fit into the rest of Indonesia, and I think people have to understand that it's got an association with Australia, but the association is that it doesn't want to be part of Indonesia. So if you don't want to be part of something really, really big, you naturally get involved with something off to the side. Now here I'm up to the little school. So I'm doing a... it's a different place. Here we go. I'm just looking for the school I'm going to help them go through their Remembrance Day ceremony, so that's what I'm talking about at the moment. Thanks a lot for listening.
podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.